You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which covers the months of December 2025 and January 2026. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Mid-Century Maison by Paul Goldberger, with photographs by Ethan James Green. You wonder if Gasquet, if he were not so busy designing clothes, would be happy leading architectural tours around the world. He talks to me about traveling with Frank Gehry, with whom he shares a boss, Bernard Arnault, the chief executive of LVMH, who has commissioned the architect to design several projects, most famously the Fondation Louis Vuitton, the museum at the edge of the Bois de Boulogne, another extraordinary location in which Gasquet has staged a show. The 96-year-old Gehry, Gasquet says, has helped him to a deeper understanding of Los Angeles. I love Frank Gehry, he says. I cherish him. And this is a note to the listeners. This article went to press before certain events took place in Frank Gehry's life. To continue with the article, as for the Wolf House, Gasquet says it is a work in progress. He and Kuss have been building on the prior owner's work, tweaking a few details, updating the mechanical systems, and restoring the pool, a composition of white tile whose angular shape reflects the lines of the house, but somehow lost its original surfacing over the years. And they have brought in their own furniture, which is far from the cautious, consumer-friendly mid-century modern furniture that fills so many houses of that period. No Eames or Brewer or Saarinen chairs here. Instead, the couple has added less common modern pieces like a chaise by Martin Siskley, a pair of armchairs by Paolo De Janello, and two classic lounge chairs by Jean-Michel Franck. Their goal is not to change the house, but to gently make it their own. Uncertain about what art they wanted in the two-story living room, Gasquet and Kuss each chose a classic film poster that they attached, unframed, to the wall, a way of both celebrating their love of film and asserting their presence in a manner that would not affect the architecture. Gasquet's selection was Gloria, with Jenna Rollins from 1980. For Kuss, it was a French poster for the 1971 movie The Devils, with Vanessa Redgrave and Oliver Reed. The previous owners had a grand piano in a glass-enclosed corner of the living room, which Gasquet and Kuss replaced with an elegant, minimalist turntable for vinyl records, set on a trio of stone tables by Comme des Garçons. Their collection includes Joy Division's compilation album, Substance, as well as soundtracks from The Graduate and Alien. Next photo, La La Land. It is the opposite of the Paris life we have, Gasquet says, of the slower-paced routine he and Kuss have adopted in Los Angeles. The living room is at once monumental and intimate, but then again, you could say that about the entire house. There is only one bedroom, a suite below the living room, an adjacent guest house, added by Lautner 2 years after the main house was completed, has two additional bedrooms, with an outdoor seating area containing a fire pit between the two structures. From the street, the complex appears so understated as to be almost invisible. You don't see much except the carport. And then you notice that it is punctuated by a couple of angular details that recall the work of Wright. And you sense that there is something more going on than another minimalist house tucked into the Hollywood Hills. The house unfolds slowly and cinematically. A huge eucalyptus tree comes into view. then a flight of steps leading down the hill, lined by a zigzagging concrete wall. You turn to the left, and there is a glass entry door leading to a small vestibule, and then, once inside the house, you turn again to the right, and a long staircase leads down to the living room, with a stone wall on one side and a glass wall to the eucalyptus and the landscape on the other. And then you look ahead, and you see a wall of glass, nearly 20 feet high, enclosing the living room and opening onto an outdoor deck. And then suddenly you realize that you are looking out over all of Los Angeles. At that point, you are torn, as Lautner wanted you to be. You can open one of the 16-foot glass doors and go outside, or you can turn back into the living room and see how he has played off high spaces, low intimate corners, and grand views, as his mentor Wright loved to do. The house has more of the feeling of Wright than most of Lautner's architecture from the 1960s and 1970s, a point where his instincts toward a kind of romantic futurism seem to be on the rise. The Wolf House was designed not long after Wright's death in 1959, and while there is no way to be certain, it is possible that Lautner, grieving, made the house a kind of homage to his architectural guru. It is still very much Lautner's own. The spiral staircase down to the primary suite, and the staircase down another level to the pool on its own deck, and the stone walls and sections built around enormous old trees. They all remind you of how closely this house is tied to its site, a narrow, steep slice of land that by some measures would be considered almost unbuildable. But that, of course, is what you could say about Wright's most famous house, Falling Water, perched over a waterfall in southwestern Pennsylvania. This house, too, both defers to nature and straddles it. The Wolf House is in the middle of a metropolis, but for Gesquer, it is as much a sanctuary as Falling Water. "It is the opposite of the Paris life we have," he says to me. "We take hikes around the Hollywood Hills and in places like the trails in Coldwater Canyon Park. And we go to the movies at the IPIC, where you can sit in comfortable seats and have a cocktail." He has become so comfortable in his home that he has all but abandoned the office he has set up for himself in a small room next to the gym. "I love to make my drawings everywhere, at the kitchen table, out on the terrace. You open the big glass doors and go out on the terrace, and you forget if you're inside or outside. It is like the whole house is a studio. It is a fantastic place to work. And when we leave it to go back to Paris, it feels like saying goodbye to a person you love." When Gesquer is planning one of his collections that will be shown in the surroundings of a great work of architecture, he says he thinks about what he imagines people would wear in that place. And at home in Los Angeles, he is similarly inspired by the Lautner house that is now his own. "In my head, I am inventing the perfect wardrobe for that house." 37 hours in Hollywood, from a dawn run for Air One smoothies to sunset on Hollywood Boulevard, with stops in London, Paris, Nashville, and New York, Vanity Fair invites you to ramble and roam the corridors of a global industry at a crossroads. Jeremy O'Harris narrates the journey. Opening illustration by Triborough, which shows the article's title as if it were the Hollywood sign perched on the hills. 6:03 a.m. Pacific Time, Beverly Hills, the future. The sun rises over Erewhon to find the future of Hollywood in line at the Tonic Bar, assistants scrambling to make their presence known during the morning juice run, navigating the demands of bosses, exploring weekly fad diets, depending on the microdose or peptide their hottest clients are taking. The future are the backbone of an industry many of us only know from episodes of Entourage, a show that premiered before some of them were born. They're the first to touch every call, to open every email, and to cover every script. But with the steady march of AI into the halls of power, some fear their time in the industry might amount to nothing more than a Malibu mango smoothie. In the meantime, they still have at assistants versus agents, where they can air the wildest demands of their bosses, and only humans can understand those. 7:15 a.m. Pacific Time, or 3:15 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, Shepherd's Bush, London, Lewis Hamilton, more than 5,000 miles away, F1 driver, dandy, and film producer Lewis Hamilton multitask in style, reading scripts and rolling calls while getting his hair braided at 3D Salon. Soaring to the heights of one industry is no longer enough, and Hamilton stands as the preeminent exemplar of Hollywood's new generation of superstar. Up next, a documentary for Apple. To win, to survive, means to thrive in every genre, with brilliant tresses and as one of the flyest dressers. 8:17 a.m. Pacific Time, Hollywood, David Ellison. Back in L.A., the most talked-about man in Hollywood arrives on the Paramount lot. David Ellison was once an aspiring actor who so loved aviation that he helped finance a film in which he played a pilot opposite James Franco. Now he's flown to more ambitious heights. He scored an Oscar nomination for Top Gun Maverick, merged Paramount with his company Skydance, and is spearheading an attempted acquisition of Warner Brothers Discovery. Depending on whom you ask, Ellison is either a media savior, investing in content, championing filmmakers, or the architect of its demise, naming lightning rod journalist Barry Weiss as head of CBS News, laying off 1,000 people. What's not in question is that the man dubbed the first millennial mogul is the most important new power broker in Hollywood, and he has vision. 8:32 a.m. Pacific Time, or 5:32 p.m. CEST, 8th Arrondissement, Paris. Ayo Edebiri. Back in Europe, Hollywood's latest ingenue, a term Ayo Edebiri pokes fun at in interviews, snaps a picture of photographer Tyler Mitchell at Le Bristol Hotel as the two prepare to attend Matthew Blazy's Chanel debut at the Grand Palais. It's an auspicious day, Edebiri's first appearance as Blasi's new muse and ambassador. As she heads to the show, the multi-hyphenate artist is manifesting the dreams of black girls everywhere who have waited for a young star who looks like them to be seated in the front row. 10:20 a.m. Pacific Time, or 6:20 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, Slough, England, Sean Levy, across the channel in Britain, where our blockbusters are increasingly filmed, an entire universe is coming alive at Pinewood Studios on the set of Sean Levy's Star Wars Starfighter, with Ryan Gosling and Mia Goth. The man who shaped many a millennial child's imagination with TV shows like The Secret World of Alex Mack and the famous Jet Jackson has done the near impossible and continued to shape their imagination into adulthood. Levy's work as a producer and director has taken him from comedy, Date Night, to drama, All the Light We Cannot See, to spandex, Deadpool and Wolverine, and now to space opera. In an industry that consistently struggles to reward those who navigate roads less traveled, he's an exception. 12 p.m. Pacific Time, Miracle Mile, Michael Govan. As CEO and director of LACMA, Michael Govan, seen here in the museum's new Zumthor-designed David Geffen Galleries with curator Leah Lembeck, is not afraid to cause a stir. Earlier this year, Govan previewed the reported $835 million gallery to a select audience, setting off an avalanche of op-eds and social hot takes before any art even graced its walls. Almost two decades into his tenure, Govan has made LACMA the preeminent art museum in Los Angeles, anchored by its annual gala, co-hosted this year by Gucci creative director Demna, and championing artists like Tavares Strachan. 1:40 p.m. Pacific Time, Beverly Hills, Jason Blum and Matthew Bologna. Everyone knows this town runs on one thing, good gossip. At the grill, a mogul and muckraker are having a late power lunch, off the record, of course. Jason Blum, producer of the Paranormal Activity and Insidious series, leans in with his trademark boyish brio to listen as entertainment journalist Matthew Bologna, one part town troublemaker, one part town crier, 100% town addiction, regales him with stories that can't ever be published in Puck. That's what lunch is for. 3:35 p.m. Pacific Time, Mid-City. La Roche. After lunch, shopping, La Roche scours the racks at recess for pieces once destined for the dustbin. As he said many times before, Law doesn't style, he architects, making moments for stars and starlets across the globe. One wonders what happens to these monuments of style that he so uniquely builds, and the collective gasp that they elicit. Perhaps they end up back in a consignment shop like this one, patiently awaiting their next red carpet moment in 2053. 5:47 p.m. Pacific Time, 7:47 p.m. Eastern Time in Nashville. Somber, youth, even for the young, is an impossible thing to capture. But like a 21st century Rimbaud, Somber, with his more than 56 million monthly listeners on Spotify, comes deliciously close. His puppy love songs are inescapable on TikTok and pop radio, and he's captured the hearts of a legion of Gen Z fans. It's time for a final sound check before his show at the Nashville Municipal Auditorium. And at well above 6 feet tall, with a waist dreamed up by Eddie Slimane, even his figure is impossibly aspirationally young. 10:08 p.m. Pacific Time, Silver Lake, Rachel Sinnott. From a different world to girls, navigating the unique challenges of growing up has been a rich topic for Hollywood. Now, Rachel Sinnott, who captured the internet's attention with her viral videos, has submitted her entry into the canon with her new series, I Love L.A. After a late dinner at Bar Stella with co-writers Emma Barry and Max Silvestri, Sinnott puts her feet up and enjoys her status as the new zillennial It Girl. 1:03 a.m. Pacific Time, Koreatown, Paris Goebel. You haven't been to a proper gay guy music video night if you haven't witnessed one of choreographer Paris Goebel's infectious performances and found yourself out of your seat jumping with glee. From Rihanna at the Super Bowl to Lady Gaga at Coachella, Goebel has articulated a choreography for a whole generation of dance enthusiasts on social media. Tonight, she's getting her fans on the dance floor, spinning a set at Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, including some of her original songs. 7:04 a.m. Pacific Time, 10:04 a.m. Eastern Time, Hudson River, New York, Benny Safdie. The next morning in New York, Benny Safdie, one half of everyone's favorite auteur brothers, sets sail on the Hudson to snap some pictures and find inspiration in his home city. In 2023, Benny acknowledged a creative split from his brother Josh, and they've been swatting down rumors of a feud ever since. After receiving the Venice Film Festival's award for Best Director for his movie The Smashing Machine, starring Dwayne Johnson, Benny is enjoying some time off before he's seen co-starring in Christopher Nolan's highly anticipated The Odyssey, and gets down to work on Lizard Music, his next collaboration with Johnson. 11 a.m. Pacific Time, DTLA, Gustavo Dudamel, back on the West Coast. Gustavo Dudamel rehearses Mahler's Second Symphony with the Los Angeles Philharmonic at the Walt Disney Concert Hall. The alluring conductor, who has captured the imagination of both classical music and Hollywood, is about to achieve a feat of double duty. Not only is 2026 his last as music and artistic director of the LA Phil, it's also his first in a similar role at the New York Philharmonic, where he will fully assume the role of music and artistic director for the 2026-27 season. In February, he'll conduct a reimagining of Goethe's Egmont, adapted for Cate Blanchett. 1:15 p.m. Pacific Time, Hollywood Hills, Dakota Johnson and Roe Donnelly. At a cozy Spanish-style bungalow that they've transformed into an office, Dakota Johnson, the beguiling actor and anchor of Celine Song's $108 million juggernaut materialist, reads scripts over lunch with her business partner, Roe Donnelly. The setting matches the duo's laid-back vibe. What sets Tea Time Pictures, their production company launched in 2019, apart from many others, is its commitment to early career directors like Cha-Cha Real Smooth's Cooper Rafe and Daddy-O's Christy Hall. Next up, Johnson is preparing for her feature directorial debut, A Tree is Blue, which is set to star Charlie XCX and Jessica Alba. 1:35 p.m. Pacific Time, Manhattan Beach, James Cameron. When we speak of the innovators, the greats, those who give us hope in the human spirit as machines threaten our future, we think of James Cameron. With each outing, he has outdone himself so much that we have taken for granted that he's invented technologies to make his films that have extended far beyond the production studio, all while shattering box office records. In his Manhattan Beach studios, surrounded by props from his juggernaut films, from The Terminator to Avatar, Cameron recreates the iconic graveyard scene from Hamlet. His performance capture, head rig filling in for poor Yorick's skull, a technological proxy of potentially infinite jest. 1:55 p.m. Pacific Time, 9:55 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, Covent Garden, London, Sadie Sink. After a long day filming for the upcoming Spider-Man movie in a top-secret role that is fueling a web of internet rumors, Sadie Sink is getting ready for bed at the Rosewood, London. After completing the upcoming season of Stranger Things, the show that launched her to global stardom, and being nominated for a Tony in the Broadway hit John Proctor is the Villain, Sink deserves a good night's sleep. 2:03 p.m. Pacific Time, or 5:03 p.m. Eastern Time, Chelsea, New York. Jennifer Venditti, to have the eye, the unimpeachable talent, to recognize a star, is one of the rarest gifts in our industry. Casting director Jennifer Venditti has it. From the late Angus Cloud and Hunter Schafer in Euphoria, to the dynamic faces you see across the Safdie oeuvres, Venditti has discovered some of our most dynamic actors. So much so that she literally wrote the book on it. A24 published Can I Ask You a Question? The Art and Alchemy of Casting in 2021. This year, the Academy Awards will be introducing an Achievement in Casting category for the first time. With Venditti's impressive work on Bugonia, Marty Supreme, and The Smashing Machine, she's in pole position. 4:33 p.m. Pacific Time, Beverly Hills, Nikki Glaser. This year, the mother of all Hollywood roast did the seemingly impossible. Nikki Glaser made the Golden Globes fun again. Her libidinal and riotous set returned what was once widely considered awards season's most enjoyable night to its former glory. Up next, Glaser will co-write and star in a Judd Apatow-produced romantic comedy, and the town sits on pins and needles, wondering if her Globes sequel will be as good. But first, she has this Sunday roast to prepare. 5:03 p.m. Pacific Time, Hollywood. Tyana Taylor, from music to dance to acting, is there anything Tyana Taylor can't do? Her turn as Perfidia Beverly Hills, a complex revolutionary and reluctant mother in Paul Thomas Anderson's opus One Battle After Another, has earned her widespread praise. She's also co-starring alongside Kim Kardashian in Ryan Murphy's All's Fair, and will be seen opposite Ben Affleck and Matt Damon in The Rip next year. Tonight, she's getting ready at the Hotel Roosevelt, her kids in tow, for one of her many red carpet appearances. Her next stop just may be the Oscar stage. 7:27 p.m. Pacific Time, Hollywood. Jimmy Kimmel. Who better to cap off our 37 hours in Hollywood than Jimmy Kimmel, back at his studio revisiting A Good News Day. This September, in the face of censorship, Kimmel unwittingly became a beacon that united everyone from anti-fascist to Ted Cruz. Soon, there were calls to boycott Disney and protest an administration that would dare take away an American's right to laugh and to free speech. Perhaps as more rights come under attack, Americans will remember this moment of collective power. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with a portrait by Gil Button, Ruth E. Carter, Ryan Coogler's go-to costume designer, the two-time Oscar winner who breathed life into Spike Lee's earlier masterpieces and conjured up Black Panther's signature style on taking a seminal trip to Egypt, wearing status pajamas and telling her doctor little white lies. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Having the ability to get up in the morning with no deadlines, walk a mile just before the sun rises, yoga after that, eat a healthy breakfast with my coffee, sit down with a book, and start a new canvas. What is your greatest fear? Oversleeping on the biggest day of a film when the number one star has a new costume to establish. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Rosa Parks. Which living person do you most admire? My older sister Debbie. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I can't say no to ice cream after a meal. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Miscommunication and lack of initiative. What is your greatest extravagance? Gucci pajamas. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Virginity. On what occasion do you lie? During the questionnaire that my doctor gives me. What do you dislike most about your appearance? Honestly, nothing. I've accepted who I am inside and out. Which living person do you most despise? Anybody who hurts a child. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My dog, Cookie. When and where were you happiest? At the pyramids in Egypt on the set of Malcolm X. Which talent would you most like to have, picking the winning lottery numbers? What is your current state of mind? Peaceful bliss. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? That they would take care of themselves and each other more. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Paying off my mother's house and seeing my designs in my current traveling exhibition. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A thing. I'd come back as an ocean. What is your most treasured possession? My Oscars. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Boredom. Where would you like to live? At home. I'm always on the road. What do you most value in your friends? Humor and intellect. Who are your favorite writers? Ryan Coogler and Shonda Rhimes. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? The Dora Milaje or Adored Ones, the all-female elite warriors that serve as the bodyguards to the Black Panther and protectors of the nation of Wakanda. What are your favorite names? Zinzi, Yara. What is it that you most dislike? When people aren't truthful about their abilities and I buy into it. How would you like to die? In my sleep. What is your motto? Trust your voice. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Ruth E. Carter. Killer Instincts. William Noguera was sentenced to death after an act of rage as a teenager that he never stopped regretting. But his redemption arc while incarcerated brought him perilously close to some of the most violent criminals in America, including Joseph Nasso, a convicted serial killer whose true body count and culpability became Noguera's mission to expose, by Rachel Dodes. Opening photos, Fear Factor, evidence collected from the home of Joseph Nasso, pictured here, including a handwritten list of 10 anonymous girls and an incredibly disturbing scene in his garage of mannequins dangling from the ceiling. The last time anybody saw Charlotte Cook was January 3, 1974. That afternoon, the college student and community organizer, a young mother and widow, left her home in Oakland to visit her sister in San Francisco. Decked out in disco-era style, knee-high boots, a blue sleeveless blouse, and a camel hair coat. When her body was discovered the following day at the bottom of a bluff overlooking Thornton Beach in Daly City, California, a brown belt wrapped around her neck, it was the description of her expensive camel's hair coat in local press reports that led her father to identify her. She was 19. Cook's daughter, now 52, says that when she was growing up in her great-grandparents' home, nobody in their close-knit family, not her great-grandparents, not her aunts or uncles, would ever talk about her mother. Anytime the name Charlotte Cook came up, a hush would descend over the room, indicating the topic was off-limits, too painful. "I never knew what to think," says Freedom Cook, a massage therapist, activist, and preschool teacher in Vallejo, California. "I just thought I had a mom, and she was just out in the world somewhere, and I don't know what happened." Freedom was 12 when one of her aunts finally informed her that her mother was dead. For decades, nobody knew who was responsible for Charlotte Cook's death. Then, in January, Freedom was shocked to learn that the man who murdered her mother was almost certainly Joseph Nasso, a 91-year-old convicted serial killer, a death row inmate at California's San Quentin prison. Even more surprising was that Charlotte's murder, Daly City's oldest active cold case, was solved not by the local police, but by William A. Noguera, another convicted murderer at San Quentin. Noguera, who served 36 years on death row, calls himself the Jane Goodall of serial killers because he spent more time embedded with them in their habitat than practically anyone, including FBI profilers and forensic psychologists. One of the killers he closely observed on death row was Nasso. In spite of overwhelming evidence, Nasso has never publicly admitted to killing anyone, but during the 10 years that Noguera overlapped with him at San Quentin, Noguera says he got him to reveal his secrets by pretending to be his friend and protector. Next photo, sham artist. Nasso used press credentials to gain trust with his victims, such as this ID taken into evidence. Armed with 300 pages of notes about his interactions with Nasso, containing descriptions of alleged victims and the timing and circumstances of their deaths, Noguera then wrote to Kenneth Maines, a cold case detective he saw on TV, and persuaded him to collaborate with him to identify more victims. Thus far, the convict cop duo has linked Nasso to 4 unsolved murders, and they are working on solving several more. Maines, a compact man with a closely cropped gray beard, arms covered in sleeves of tattoos, and a large cross dangling from his neck, admits it's an unlikely friendship, convict and cop, adding that without Noguera, none of this would be happening. Although he's based in rural Lycoming County, Pennsylvania, Maines is currently in contact with the San Francisco office of the FBI, and is providing intelligence to 6 police departments across the country, including Northern California, Las Vegas, and Rochester, New York. Maines and detectives involved with investigating the cold cases believe that Nasso, convicted in 2013 of 4 murders, is possibly responsible for as many as 22 more. That would make Nasso among the most prolific serial killers in American history, perhaps more deadly than better-known murderers like Ted Bundy, 20 victims, Jeffrey Dahmer, 17 victims, and Richard Ramirez, 13 victims. Nasso currently resides at a medical facility for inmates in Stockton, California. He was moved from San Quentin in 2023 amid California Governor Gavin Newsom's efforts at prison reform. When I wrote him a letter seeking a comment on the new allegations, he wrote back, "First, send me a book of stamps." The following day, I mailed him a book of Forever U.S. flag stamps, a few pieces of extra stationery, and another letter requesting an interview. A couple weeks later, the envelope was returned to the post office box I had set up for the purposes of communicating with Nasso. I heard back a few weeks later via GTL Getting Out, an app used by inmates to communicate. "Send me your phone number right now," he texted. I replied with a burner phone number, but he didn't call. The following weekend, I received another letter from him, in all caps, advising me not to ever send him text messages, writing, "Do not talk to anyone except me." I wrote back with a series of questions and asked him to answer via mail or to call me, explaining that my deadline was rapidly approaching and that if he wanted to comment, he would have to respond quickly. But instead of answering the questions, he asked me to send me a photo of your face and your age in exchange for a rare photo of me, not seen by the media nor the DA. I did not respond. For more than 60 years, Nasso hid in plain sight. He was once a little league coach and Cub Scout leader, a husband and a father of 2. He worked as a family photographer and even briefly taught a photography course at the Academy of Art College in San Francisco. But he lived a second reality, the life of a serial killer, raping and murdering young women, allegedly beginning in 1965 through at least 1994. He had also been arrested for lesser crimes, such as battery, disturbing the peace, unemployment insurance fraud, shoplifting women's undergarments, and petty theft and grand larceny, which is how he was busted in 2008. Following a routine probation check in April 2010, he was arrested in Reno, where he was living at the time. The cops were horrified by what they saw, a home bursting with clutter, dirty dishes piled on kitchen counters, and food lying all over, including rotting meat. "The only thing that I could relate it to would be the silence of the lambs," says Wendell Anderson, the detective who executed a search warrant on Nasso's house after probation officers found laminated articles from Yuba County's hometown newspaper, The Appeal Democrat, about 2 murders that took place there in the early 90s. Affixed to the articles were photographs of the victims, posed and wearing lingerie, believed to have been taken by Nasso after he had strangled them. Anderson, now the sheriff of Yuba County, remembers being struck by the photography equipment and thousands of pictures of women, mostly in stockings with seams up the back, hanging on the walls and stacked on every surface. Nasso told the police that he wore women's pantyhose for a skin condition on his legs. According to a search warrant affidavit filed with the Yuba County Sheriff's Office and seen by Vanity Fair, in the garage, 10 mannequins wearing makeup and lingerie dangled by their necks from the ceiling, the nooses made of sheer pantyhose. In one bedroom, pairs of pantyhose were tied around each post of Nasso's 4-poster bed. 2 other bedrooms were padlocked from the outside. There was a rape journal, as police called it, detailing more than 100 alleged sex crimes dating back to the 1950s. I would pose as the professional glamour photog, always looking for new models plus talent. What a great scam, Nasso wrote in the journal, recounting a sexual encounter in Rochester in the late 1950s. Nasso was charged twice with sexual assault, in 1958 and 1961, but the victims refused to testify and he walked free. But the most alarming piece of evidence was a ripped-out sheet of notebook paper in Nasso's kitchen. A handwritten list of 10 described unnamed women in various locations. Girl near Healdsburg, Mendocino County, or girl on Mount Tam. I knew without a doubt that those 10 on that list were homicide victims, says Anderson, who has kept the Nasso file on his desk for the past 15 years. We just didn't know where they were or who they were. Even though prosecutors in Marin County suspected Nasso had committed at least 10 murders, they only had enough evidence to charge him with 4 in a 17-year period beginning in 1977. Each woman had an alliterative name: Carmen Colon, Roxine Rogash, Pamela Parsons, and Tracy Tafoya, who matched the descriptions of numbers 2, 3, 9, and 10 on Nasso's list, respectively. He was dubbed the alphabet killer in media reports when he was caught. Additional evidence collected by police from Nasso's home and safe deposit box allegedly linked him to 2 more dead women, Sharia Patton and Sarah Dillon, matching the descriptions of numbers 7 and 8, though Nasso has never been charged with their murders. The identities of the remaining 4 women on the list, numbers 1, 4, 5, and 6, remained a mystery to law enforcement. Now police believe number 5, girl from Miami near Down Peninsula, was Charlotte Cook. All it took was a collision of fate and the desire of another man to repay his debt to society in the wake of a different murder. Next photos. Confessing his sins. While they were incarcerated together, Nasso presented William Nogueira with a letter ostensibly admitting to more crimes. And Lynn Kahns, the girl from Berkeley. Nogueira has been incarcerated since December 1983, when he was arrested for killing his then-girlfriend's mother in a steroid-fueled fit of rage after learning of his girlfriend's abortion. An Orange County jury sentenced him to death, making him one of the youngest people in California history at the time of his crime to receive such a harsh punishment. The reason the death penalty was even on the table was the so-called special circumstances surrounding the murder. Prosecutors believed, owing to testimony from a witness who was later determined to be lying, that Nogueira and his girlfriend had conspired to benefit from a $13,000 life insurance policy held by the victim. Nogueira's ex-girlfriend declined to testify at his trial, for which she was held in contempt, but she later wrote a declaration supporting his appeal, stating that her mother was abusive and had coerced her to terminate her pregnancy. At 18 years of age, I took a human life, and I take full responsibility for what I did, says Nogueira, who called me from Corcoran State Prison in Corcoran, California, about 50 miles south of Fresno. It would be very special for me to be able to give back in some way and allow these families to at least have some finalization. He doesn't believe in closure, not in situations like this. Nogueira turned his life around in prison. His mixed-media paintings, using acrylic paint, newspaper clippings, and ground-up prison yard concrete, have earned him awards and gallery representation. His work is currently exhibited at the Elder Gallery of Contemporary Art in Charlotte, North Carolina, owned by attorney Sonia Pfeiffer. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available at our website as a podcast, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.